WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, in for Terry Gross. Last month, Ingrid Mattson became the first woman to be elected president of the Islamic Society of North America. She had served as vice president since 2001. Mattson was raised Roman Catholic in Canada and went to a Catholic high school, but converted to Islam in 1987 when she was in college. Now she's a professor of Islamic studies at Hartford Seminary in Connecticut. The Islamic Society of North America was established in 1963 and is now the largest group representing Muslims in North America. It supports Muslim communities and tries to build bridges to other religions. Terry spoke with Ingrid Mattson yesterday.
Ingrid Mattson, welcome to Fresh Air. Now, you are the first woman, the first Native North American, and the first convert to be elected president of the Islamic Society of North America. Which of those firsts have you been getting the most comments about?
Certainly being the first woman has generated the most interest among people. I had expected that. I was, frankly, a little bit surprised at the amount of interest in the fact that I'm a native-born North America, and in particular that I'm a white North American, was something that I didn't expect to generate quite so much interest.
And what has been the nature of the reaction to that, to you being Native North American and white?
To some extent, I found it a little bit troubling because there's some underlying almost racist implications to me in that Muslims really should not be white people. They should be people of color. Of course, there's nothing wrong with being a person of color, and the reality is that in North America, most Muslims are people of color, but it's almost a kind of unease that that someone who is maybe from the privileged race would decide to join the Muslim community.
Now, you grew up Catholic and went to Catholic school. You later converted to Islam. When you were Catholic, were you deeply involved in Catholicism? And did you ever even think of becoming a nun?
I think the only time it ever occurred to me to become a nun was or the only reason I would have thought of becoming a nun was that the convent was just so peaceful. And I grew up in a family of seven kids with four brothers and two sisters. So my house was always in motion. You know, it was constant chaos. And I used to go to the convent and think, this is so nice and peaceful. But on the other hand, I also used to go to the library, which was at the other end of the street, and think the same thing. So perhaps that's why both scholarship and a religious life appealed to me as I got older.
How were you introduced to Islam?
Well, I was, you know, I left the church when I was perhaps 15 years old. I lost my faith around that time and stopped attending church. I spent perhaps 6 years as an agnostic or an atheist. I really don't even know now what I believed at that time. Went on, studied philosophy, and pretty much left religion behind, not thought of it as an option for my life. But then I went to Paris for a summer where I was studying film with my fine arts program and made very good friends with some West African students who happened to be Muslim. And they weren't particularly observant Muslims, but there was something in them that was so lovely, so attractive, their generosity and humility and kindness, that I wanted to know more about them and their life and their culture, and found out that Islam was part of it and started reading more about it and found myself, to my surprise, drawn in to this faith.
And when did you convert?
I was in my last year of university, a senior in college, when I became a Muslim.
What was your parents' reaction?
Well, my father died when I was young, so I was living with my mother at the time, and I was very concerned about her reaction because, like all teenagers, I hadn't always given my mother the easiest time, and she'd had a rough time since my father had died, raising seven kids on her own. So I didn't want to give her something that would be upsetting, and I knew this would be difficult for her to understand. And it was. We didn't know any Muslims, so it was more a question of a vague unease about what this was all about. So it took some time, and more than anything, I think it just took her seeing what this meant in my life to make her feel comfortable.
One of the things you did after you converted to Islam was go to Pakistan, where you worked in a refugee camp for Afghan women. What year was this?
This was in 1987 when I went to Pakistan.
Oh, okay. So it was a long time ago. This was, the Soviets were still in Afghanistan then?
That's right. There was still active fighting in Afghanistan, and mm-hmm. I went to Pakistan, lived in Peshawar, and was working in refugee camps outside of the city.
And what kind of interactions did you have with the Taliban?
Well, they weren't really known as Taliban, but at that time. It was only some years later that they became more constituted as a kind of force. At that time, there were all sorts of groups operating and working among the Afghans, political parties as well as religious organizations. And the Taliban-type person, I knew. I mean, I ran into some of those people in the refugee camp. There were some areas in the camp that I worked in. It was a camp of 100,000 people where the leaders really were not interested in having women's or girls' education. But in fact, what was interesting was that was a very small segment of the population of the camp. The vast majority of Afghans, men and women, wanted us in there, wanted, you know, us to offer programs, health and education, reading and writing for girls as well as for boys. But it was only in some small areas where there were men who could keep us out. And what really struck me when the Taliban took over was that I knew that the only way they could do that was through the force of those tanks and the arms that they had, because the Afghan people generally were not convinced of their ideas or supportive of the kind of lifestyle that they were advocating, despite the fact that Afghans, by and large, are very religious people, and they consider themselves good Muslims, but not at all in the way that the Taliban interpret Islam.
Now, I understand you have a sister who converted to Judaism.
Yes, that's right.
And I think that's because she was marrying somebody who was Jewish.
That's right.
So it seems not typical to have a family in which two of the children converted to different religions.
Well, I guess it isn't. Perhaps it's becoming more typical in as society continues to globalize and we mm-hmm. interact with more and more people. But in a family of seven kids, yes, two of us chose another path, and I learned a lot from my sister. You know, I'm glad that I had her to talk to and as an example. Although we made our choice for very different reasons, but I've watched her over the years balance her her lifestyle and beliefs with still being a part of our family. So that was a good example for me. And also, my sister is a number of years older than I am, so what was good about that is that I had a long experience with the Jewish community before I was Muslim. I've gone to Jewish weddings, and my nephew's bris and bar mitzvah, my niece's bet mitzvah. So I'm very comfortable in Jewish religious settings and with Jewish people. I think that helps me as a Muslim leader bring some balance to our community or perspective to our community that often finds itself in some kind of tension with the Jewish community.
Yeah, so how do you deal with this like anti-Semitic strain within parts of the Islamic community?
Well, it needs to be dealt with first theologically. It's not permissible for a Muslim to hate a person because they're Jewish or to tell ridiculous lies about Jews or to make absurd claims like the Holocaust is not real or was exaggerated. I mean, it's a question of knocking those things down very quickly, but then also on the other side, working with the Jewish community to dispel their misconceptions, because I believe there are as many misconceptions on the part of the Jewish community about Muslims as there are on the other side. And there are there is anti-Muslim rhetoric as well. Certainly there are differences and there are some tensions, but there doesn't have to be hostility and conflict.
We're listening to Terry's interview with Ingrid Mattson, the new president of the Islamic Society of North America. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with Ingrid Mattson. Last month, she became the first woman elected as president of the Islamic Society of North America.
This week, an organization of 56 Islamic nations urged the Pope to apologize for his comments about Islam. The Pope had quoted a 14th century Byzantine Christian emperor who said, "Show me just what Muhammad brought that was new, and there you will find things only evil and inhuman, such as his command to spread by the sword the faith he preached." What's your understanding of what the Pope was intending to communicate when he quoted that?
Well, I read a translation of the whole speech from beginning to end, and his main point was that he was making was that Christianity has come to terms with reason, and because Christianity has come to terms with reason and rationality is the basis of European civilization, that Christianity can form the cultural base for European civilization. But Islam, on the other hand, is a religion that is irrational, that does not believe in a rational God or a rational order, divine order. And therefore, the implication being, and an implication that he's spelled out in other speeches, that Islam will always remain to some extent foreign to the European continent and civilization. And that, to me, is the most troubling aspect of his speech.
Now, you grew up Roman Catholic. You went to a Catholic high school and then in college converted to Islam. Now, you teach, among other things, Muslim-Christian relations. So what are some of the things that you feel like Muslims and Christians don't get about each other but need to comprehend?
I think that Christians, first of all, need to have more facts about the reality of the interaction between Christians and Muslims over the centuries, and Christians, Muslims, and maybe even Jews over the centuries. People often say things like, well, people in the Middle East have been fighting for thousands of years, or they've always been in conflict. But historically, that's just not accurate. There are all sorts of great historical studies that show wonderful examples of cooperation, of synthesis, of intermarriage, of communal harmony, of trade, mutual support. At the same time, there are cases of conflict, and I think Christians need to be more aware of the role of Christianity really in that, and the fact that for many centuries, the Catholic Church especially was a very oppressive force against not only Muslims, but Jews as well. And with respect to Muslims need to understand why Christians embraced a secular civilization, that was a rational decision in the wake of so many centuries of religious conflict in which religious identity in Europe was conflated with citizenship. And that's why European countries moved to a secular society. It wasn't because they were trying to get rid of religion or because they were being irreligious, but because they wanted to not allow religion to be used for the purpose of oppression or political manipulation anymore. So Muslims really need to come to understand that so they can understand their place and role in these countries.
You know, this week, a German opera house canceled performances of a Mozart opera because of a scene that was added to the opera. And in this scene, the king of Crete carries the heads of Muhammad, Jesus, and Buddha. and those heads are placed on a stool. Now, police warned that because Muslims would find this scene inflammatory, that there was an incalculable risk to the performers and the audience, and I think they were already getting death threats. Now, the opera company is being criticized in Germany for not standing up for artistic freedom. What do you make of this latest conflict between, a secular art performance and Muslims who are offended by it?
Mm. Well, it doesn't bother me if Muslims are offended by it. I would be offended by it as well, not only by the way Muhammad would be portrayed by, but other prophets as well, just as I've been offended by some art that has, used Christian icons in a disrespectful way. I understand artists have a right to express themselves and to try to bring people into their world and understand what they're trying to do. At the same time, religious people and others have a right to be offended, to voice their offense. The line, of course, is drawn at threats of violence. At that point, then those people need to be found by the police and questioned and charged if they actually made a threat of violence. I do think that sometimes, I don't want to diminish the risk. Obviously, the police have assessed the risk. But at the same time, sometimes I just wonder if these things aren't a little bit overblown in the media. And the reason I say that is in a country like Germany, where there are racist attacks on Muslims all the time. Not just threats, but real beatings, very violent attacks. And those aren't things that end up getting global attention. So I think it's an important issue. It's more of a local issue. I really don't think it's something that necessarily needs to attract kind of international attention when we look at all of the other things that are going on.
I guess here's one of the things I'm wondering. A lot of people feel that extremists are hijacking the Islamic religion. Extremists are interpreting the religion as justifying suicide bombing and attacks on perceived enemies. And I guess I wonder if you think that people such as you who don't interpret Islam that way are being effective in countering a more extremist point of view, or if you even see that as your job.
Well, I can only, and people like me can only use the means that are in our control. I don't have an army. I don't have an intelligence service at my command. I have my voice and my words. And so I use those in speech and writing. But the problem here is that there seems to be a feeling of group guilt or collective guilt. You know, the Muslim community is a worldwide community of over 1 billion people. There's no hierarchy, even within any country. There's no one leadership that can control all of the people, that can give orders or commands to all of the people or guide them. There's no ordination in Islam. So religious leadership is diffuse. And there's not someone who can stand up and kind of rally Muslims or direct them to do one action or another. And so you'll find people acting out of all sorts of interests and all sorts of motivations, whether it's emotional, political, whatever kind of dynamics they have. And each Muslim individual and group can only, do what is within their power. But one thing we have to look at is the reality is that the primary victims of Muslims who commit acts of terrorism are other Muslims. So if you look at the Taliban, for example, who have been their victims? They've been other Muslims. And who are the people primarily who are in the front line stopping them? They're other Muslims who are Afghani Muslims in the police force, in the military, in the government, So this is something very important for us to recognize, that here in America, we often see this as a story of Muslims against the West or Muslims against America, Muslim extremists. But in fact, Muslims have suffered more from these kinds of extremism and are doing more to try to stop them very bravely. If you look in places like Iraq and Afghanistan, where men and women are going out every day to try to teach and work in hospitals and are often losing their lives for serving their people.
We're listening to Terry's interview with Ingrid Mattson, the new president of the Islamic Society of North America. Terry spoke to Mattson yesterday. German government officials and Muslim leaders in Germany have begun a 2-year dialogue on Muslim relations. At their first meeting Wednesday, the group recommended that the Berlin Opera reinstate the Mozart opera. At the time of this broadcast, a final decision had not yet been made. We'll hear more from Ingrid Mattson after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with Ingrid Mattson. Last month, she became the first woman elected as president of the Islamic Society of North America.
We recently had on Pastor John Hagee, who's the head of a megachurch in Texas, and the founder of a Christian Zionist group. And he said in our recent interview that those who live by the Quran have a scriptural mandate to kill Christians and Jews. And I'd like to hear your reaction to that.
Well, that's incorrect. If that were true, there would not be any Jews or Christians left in Muslim lands. And in fact, the oldest Christian communities and the oldest Jewish communities are found in the world, lived under Muslim sovereignty for over 1,000 years. The Quran does not say that. And what's interesting to me is, if people like this want to be scriptural literalists in their own tradition and take verses out of context and, apply their own interpretation to them, that's fine. But they can leave my scripture alone. We have enough problems dealing with our own scriptural literalists. I don't need a Christian fundamentalist Islamic literalist, if I may say.
So do you feel like one of the big splits now within the Christian community is whether the Bible should be read as literal truth or as more parable, metaphor? Do you think there's the same kind of split now in Islam about whether the Quran should be read literally?
I think the biggest problem is that our traditional schools, our seminaries, our traditions of interpretation were dismantled to a large extent under colonialism, and what happened is a very literalistic, decontextualized approach to scripture emerged in the 19th century, and we're still trying to come out of it. Classical Islamic exegesis, in fact, gives a lot of room for context, for harmonizing different verses, for bringing perspective from outside the text. And so much of that has disappeared. And what we're trying to do is to bring that back in, that approach to the text back in, and perhaps to bring in some other kinds of context or meaning that weren't always emphasized in traditional interpretation.
Do you ever feel that, you converted to Islam, for deeply personal and spiritual reasons, and now as the leader of an Islamic group, you're kind of at the center of a storm in a way, because relations have become so stormy, and I think that there must be a rift inside Islam now between more moderate and extreme interpretations of the Quran.
Yeah, I find my life surprising. It's not exactly what I expected it to be. I did become a Muslim, as you say, for deeply personal and spiritual reasons. But what I believe as a Muslim is that if your faith is sincere, that you are willing to put yourself in God's hands, and whatever He feels is your purpose, you have to take that up. As I say, I am the kind of person who would normally be happier in the library with a book, and I find myself in a very public position now. But this is my responsibility. It's one that it's also very much a privilege, because I do get to see not only the bad things, but I get to see everyday kindness, people reaching out, trying to overcome their fears and their anxieties and their prejudices to be better themselves. So life is surprising, and I just consider myself to be in this time doing what I was destined to do.
Well, Ingrid Mattson, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you.
Thanks for the opportunity, Terry. It's been great speaking with you.
Ingrid Mattson is president of the Islamic Society of North America. Her interview with Terry was recorded yesterday.